Side 9, Cradle, by Arthur C. Clarke and Gentry Lee. Continuing on page 229. 9. Carol and Troy went over the details one last time, and she checked her watch. "It's 8:30 already," she said. "If I'm much later, I know they'll be suspicious." She was standing outside Nick's Pontiac in the parking lot of the Pelican Resort, a restaurant about three-quarters of a mile from the Ashford Mansion at Pelican Point. "Where is he?" she fretted. "We should have finished with this 15 minutes ago."
"Just calm down, Angel," Troy replied. "We have to test this new unit first. It could be very important in an emergency, and I've never actually used it." He gave her a reassuring hug. "Your friends at MOI originally developed it."
"Why did I have to suggest such a wild-ass idea?" Carol said out loud to herself. "Where's your brain, Dawson? Did you leave it in the..."
"Can you hear me?"
Nick's garbled voice interrupted her. It sounded as if it were coming from the bottom of a well.
"Yes," Troy answered into a tiny walkie-talkie shaped like a thimble. "But not too clearly. How deep are you?"
"Say again," said Nick. "I did not copy completely."
"Yes, we can hear you," Troy shouted. He carefully enunciated each word. "But not very clearly. You must speak slowly and distinctly. How deep are you?"
"About 8 feet," was the response.
"Go down to 16 and try it again," said Troy. "Let's see if it will work from the deepest part of the cave."
"How's he doing that?" Carol asked while they waited for Nick to descend.
"It's a brand new system built into the regulator," Troy answered. "You have to speak while you're exhaling for it to work. There's a small transmitter receiver inside the mouthpiece and an earphone attachment. Unfortunately, it doesn't work much below 10 feet.
Almost a minute later, Carol and Troy heard something very faint, not even recognizable as Nick's voice. Troy listened for a moment.
"We cannot read you, Nick. There is too much attenuation. Come on back now. I'm going to send Carol on her way."
Troy pressed a button on the walkie-talkie that would repeatedly transmit this last message. He handed the communications unit to Carol.
"Okay, Angel," he said. "You're ready. We should be in the water around 9 o'clock and out. If all goes well, by half an hour later. Keep them occupied with your questions. You should leave by 10:30 at the latest and drive directly to Nick's apartment. We will meet you there with your wagon." He raised his eyebrows. "And the gold, I hope."
Carol took a deep breath. She smiled at Troy. "I'm scared," she said. "I would rather face a carpet or even one of those warden things than this trio." She opened the car door. "Do you really think I should go in Nick's car? Isn't that certain to make them suspect something?"
"We've been through all this twice before, Angel," Troy laughingly replied. He gently nudged her into the car. "They already know we're friends. Besides, we need your wagon for the diving gear, the backpacks, and the lead and gold."
He closed the door and planted a light kiss on her cheek through the open window.
"Be safe, Angel," he said, "and don't take any unnecessary chances."
Carol started the car and backed into the middle of the parking lot. She waved at Troy and pulled into the dark lane that led through the marsh to the end of the island. The only light was from the nearly full gibbous moon that was already above the trees. "All right, Dawson," she thought to herself. "Now you're in the middle of it. Just stay calm and alert." She drove very slowly. She reviewed the plans for the evening several times in her mind. Then she started thinking about Nick. "He holds on to things, like I do. He still hates Homer and Greta for cheating him. He couldn't wait to die for the gold." She smiled as she turned into the circular drive in front of Homer Ashford's house. "I just hope there is some left over for him." A split second after Carol rang the doorbell, Homer opened the door and greeted her.
"You're late," he said in a pleasant monotone. "We thought maybe you were not coming. Greta is already in the pool. Do you want to change and join her?"
"Thanks, Captain Homer, but I decided not to swim tonight," Carol answered politely. "I appreciate the offer, but I'm mostly here on business. I would prefer to start the interview as soon as possible, even before dinner, if that would be all right with everyone else. Homer led Carol into a gigantic family room and stopped by a large wet bar. A magnificent hand-carved wooden statue of a swimming Neptune, about 4 feet long altogether, was on the wall above the bar. Carol asked for some white wine. Homer tried without success to talk her into something stronger. The family room had a billiards table at one end. On the other side, a sliding glass door opened onto a covered patio that narrowed into a cement walkway. Carol followed Homer in silence, sipping from her white wine every 20 steps or so. The walkway wound past big trees and a lighted gazebo off to the left before it spread out around the huge swimming pool. Actually, there were two pools. In front of Carol was a classic rectangular Olympic-sized pool under strong lights. At one end was a slide and waterfall that ran down an artificial mountain into the swimming area. At the other end, in the direction of the second pool and the ocean, there was a sunken jacuzzi constructed out of the same decorated blue tiles that rimmed the top of the main pool. The entire complex was cleverly designed to create the impression of moving water. There seemed to be a steady flow from the waterfall to the large pool, down into the jacuzzi, and then into a stream that meandered off in the direction of the house. The second pool was circular and dark. It was off to Carol's left at the edge of the property, near what looked like a small cottage for changing clothes. Greta was in the rectangular pool in front of Carol. She was swimming laps, her powerful body moving rhythmically through the water. Carol, who was an excellent swimmer herself, watched Greta for a few seconds.
"Isn't she something?" Homer walked over next to Carol. His admiration was obvious. "She won't let herself eat a big meal unless she works out beforehand. She can't stand fat."
Homer was wearing a light brown Hawaiian shirt with a pair of tan slacks. Brown loafers were on his feet, and a big drink, crammed with ice cubes, was in his hand. He seemed relaxed, even affable. Carol thought he could have passed for a retired banker or a corporate executive. Greta continued to swim relentlessly through the water. Homer was hovering over Carol, and she was beginning to feel uncomfortable, as if her space were being invaded. "Where's Ellen?" she asked, turning to the large man and moving just slightly farther away from him.
"She's in the kitchen," Homer replied. "She loves to cook, especially when we have guests. And tonight she's making one of her favorite dishes."
There was almost a twinkle in his eye. He leaned down to Carol.
"She made me promise not to tell you what we're having," he whispered confidentially. "But I will tell you that it's a powerful aphrodisiac."
"Ugh," said Carol to herself as she caught a whiff of Homer's breath and listened to his leering chuckle. "How could I have forgotten how repulsive this man is? Does he really think that..." Carol stopped her thought. She reminded herself that people with excessive money very often lose touch with reality. Probably some of the women respond. For what he can give them. She almost gagged. The thought of having any kind of sexual liaison with Homer was totally repugnant. Greta had finished swimming laps. She climbed out of the pool and dried herself off. Her all-white racing uniform was like a transparent body stocking. Even from a distance, Carol could not avoid seeing the full detail of her nipples and breasts, as well as her clump of pubic hair through the thin suit. She might as well have been naked. Homer stood beside Carol, unabashedly staring as Greta strode across the cement.
"No suit,"
Greta said just before she reached them. Her eyes were trying to bore holes in Carol's. Carol shook her head.
"I'm sorry," said Greta. "Homer had hoped that we might have a race."
She looked at the captain with an odd expression that Carol did not understand.
"He loves to see women in competition."
"It would have been no contest," Carol answered. She thought she saw Greta tense. "You would have won easily," she added. "You swim beautifully." Greta smiled, accepting the compliment. Her eyes roamed over Carol's body. She made no effort to hide the fact that she was doing an appraisal.
"You have a good body, too, for swimming," Greta said. "Maybe a little too fat on the ass and upper legs. I could suggest a workout."
"Why don't we show Miss Dawson the other pool?" Homer interrupted, "before you go inside and change clothes."
He started walking toward the little cottage near the ocean. Without saying another word, Greta turned and followed him. Carol took a sip from her wine. Who knows what goes on here, she thought. Those three have not had to work for 8 years. They take people out fishing and diving for amusement. A strange mixture of disgust and depression started to spread in her. So they manufacture entertainment to keep from being bored. Moments after Homer entered the cottage, a bank of floodlights down underneath the second pool was illuminated. Homer gestured for her to hurry, and Carol skipped into the cottage. They led her down a flight of steps. Under the ground was a walkway that completely encircled the large glass aquarium that had looked in the darkness like a second swimming pool. "We have 6 sharks now," Homer said proudly, "as well as 3 red aki, a pair of cuttlefish, and, of course, hundreds of more standard species of fish and plants."
"Aki?" inquired Carol.
"That's the slang plural of octopus," Homer responded with a smug, self-satisfied smile. "Actually, the correct plural is octopodes, even though everyone now accepts octopi because it has been used so much."
Greta was standing with her face pressed against the glass. A couple of bat rays swam past. She was waiting for something. After 20 seconds or so, a grayish shark appeared. The shark seemed to notice Greta and stopped, watching her, its face about 5 feet away from the glass. Carol could see the long, sharp teeth and identified it as a mako, a fierce, smaller cousin of the man-eating great white shark.
"That's Greta's pet," said Homer. "His name is Timmy. Somehow she has trained him to recognize her face against the glass."
Homer watched a few more seconds.
"From time to time, she goes in there to swim with him. When the sharks had finished eating, of course."
The shark remained in place, staring blankly in Greta's direction. She began to drum her fingers against the glass in regular cadence.
"Now this is exciting," Homer said, walking over next to Greta and the aquarium. "What you are going to see is what biologists call a typical Pavlovian response. I've never seen it quite this way before in a shark."
The mako began to be agitated. Greta started increasing the tempo, the shark responding by whipping the water back and forth with its tail. Suddenly, Greta disappeared up the stairs. Carol thought she noticed a faraway look in her eyes when Greta zoomed by her. Carol looked at Homer for an explanation.
"Come down here closer," he gestured to Carol. "You don't want to miss this. Greta cares for the rabbits herself. And Timmy always puts on a grand show."
Carol wasn't exactly sure what Homer was talking about, but she was enjoying the lovely aquarium. It contained crystal clear seawater, obviously filtered and recycled regularly. Carol noticed several species of sponges and coral, as well as urchin and anemone. Someone had gone to great trouble and expense to recreate the conditions in the reefs just offshore Key West. Suddenly, a beheaded white rabbit impaled on a long vertical staff, the blood still spurting from its arteries, appeared in the aquarium just opposite where Carol and Homer were standing. It was over in an instant. Driven to immediate frenzy by the blood in the water, the mako attacked, its teeth ripping half the hapless rabbit off the stave with the first bite. The second swoop captured the rest of the rabbit and snapped the rod as well. Carol barely had time to recoil and turn her head. When she jumped back, she spilled wine all over her blouse. Trying to appear calm, she reached in her purse for a tissue to wipe her blouse. She said nothing. She had had a perfect view of the shark's attack and could still feel the adrenaline imbalance that the fright had produced. "Great way to start a dinner party," she thought. "Why haven't I ever thought of it? Dawson, these people are weird." Homer was still excited.
"Wasn't that spectacular? Such raw, savage power in those jaws, driven by pure instinct. I never get tired of it."
Carol followed him up the stairs.
"Good show, Greta," she heard Homer say when they walked out of the cottage. "It was right in front of us. 2 bites. Wham, wham, and the rabbit was gone."
"I know," said Greta. She was holding a diving mask. What was left of the staff was on the ground beside her. "I could see from up here."
Greta was staring at Carol, obviously trying to discover her reaction. Carol averted her eyes. She was not going to give Greta the satisfaction of knowing she had found it repulsive. "Greta has the whole thing down to split-second timing," Homer continued as they walked back through the gardens to the house. "She prepares the live rabbit on the chopping block an hour early. Then, when Timmy is ready, she..." Carol tuned his gruesome story out of her mind. "I don't want to hear this," she thought. She glanced at her watch. 9:10. "Come on, guys. Be swift. I'm not certain I can stand these people for another hour." Nick and Troy swam silently along the shoreline in the moonlight. They had carefully rehearsed the plan. No additional light until they were in the cove beside Homer's property and at least 10 feet underwater. Troy would lead, searching for alarm systems he could disable with the tools stuffed in the pockets of his wetsuit. He would also keep a lookout for the infamous robot sentries. Nick would follow with the buoyancy bags they would use to carry the gold. They had walked along the beach from the Pelican Resort parking lot, wearing their heavy diving suits as well as the backpacks, until they were only about 100 yards from the thick fence that marked Homer's property. Then they had set down the packs containing their clothes and eased into the water. During the walk, Troy had had several problems with his tools, and a decision to reduce his arsenal of gadgets had delayed their arrival at the embarkation point by 5 minutes. Just before they went into the water, Nick had given an uncharacteristic squeal of excitement and grabbed Troy by the shoulders. "I hope that fucking gold is there," he had said. "I cannot wait to see their faces after we steal it." It was time to submerge. Holding hands in the darkness, Nick and Troy dropped about 5 feet under the water. They stopped, equalized the pressure in their heads, and repeated the procedure. When they were down about 10 feet, Troy turned on the searchlight. They quickly worked out their directions and headed around the corner, deeper into the cove adjoining Homer's estate. Troy was in the lead. He had no trouble finding the entrance to the natural tunnel that led to the subterranean cave. As they had planned, Nick waited outside the tunnel while Troy went inside to look for alarms. The rock cliffs closed over his head. The watery entryway was about 5 feet across and 4 feet high. Troy immediately found a metal box affixed to the left wall, where it was partially hidden from view. When he examined the box, he discovered that it was emitting 2 laser beams separated by about 3 feet. On the other side of the natural tunnel were the receiving plates for the beams, as well as the alarm electronics. Troy swam over carefully, pulled out his screwdriver, and dismantled the housing. The system was very simple. Failure of either plate to receive a beam would trigger the opening of a relay. When both relays were open, current could flow to the alarm. Thus, an object had to be large enough to break both beams simultaneously to set off an alarm. Troy smiled to himself as he validated the operating principle by passing his hand in front of one of the beams. Then he jerry-rigged one of the relays permanently closed. Satisfied with his work, he swam back and forth in the tunnel, breaking both beams at the same time, assuring himself that he had rendered the alarm system ineffective. He swam back out to meet Nick and gave him the thumbs-up sign. The two men passed through the 50 yards of natural tunnel into the subterranean cave. Where the narrow passageway widened, Troy again gestured to Nick to remain behind while he, Troy, went into the cave to check for booby traps. Nick let his feet fall to the bottom of the tunnel and switched on his own small flashlight. He was in a perfect place for an ambush. The tunnel was so small here that there was virtually no maneuvering room. He wondered what an underwater sentry would look like. "What a place to die," he thought suddenly. Fear swept over him as he turned off his flashlight and looked down at his illuminated diver's watch. He watched the glowing second hand sweeping around the face. He tried to calm himself. It had been 3 minutes since Troy had left. "Why is he taking so long?" he asked himself. He must have found something. Another minute passed, then another. Nick was having a hard time quelling the onset of panic. "What do I do if he doesn't return?" Just as Nick was about to swim into the cave on his own, he caught sight of Troy's searchlight coming toward him. Troy waved, and Nick followed. Within 30 seconds, they were in the shallow part of the cave, where the water was only about 4 feet deep. The two men stood up with their flippers lodged against the rocks to protect themselves from falling in the intermittent tidal surges. Nick pulled his regulator out of his mouth and flipped his mask back on his head. Before he could speak, Troy put a finger against Nick's lips.
"Speak very softly." Troy's whisper was barely audible. The place could be alarmed for sound as well.
There was no light in the cave except Troy's searchlight. However, over their heads in the highest corners of the rock ceiling, Troy pointed out two separate banks of fluorescent lighting. The cave itself was an irregular oval, about 30 yards in its longest dimension and maybe 15 yards across at its widest point. The ceiling was only about 3 feet above the water near the entrance to the tunnel out to the ocean, but it was 20 feet high in the corner where they were standing in the shallow water.
"Well, Professor," Troy continued whispering, "I have good news and bad news. The bad news is that there is no treasure here in this cave. The good news is that there are two other tunnels, both man-made, that lead away from this place and go under Captain Homer's property." He paused for a moment and watched his partner. "Shall we go for it?" Nick looked at his watch. It was 9:20 already. He nodded. "The bastard spent a lot of money down here. They must have stolen more than I figured." Nick adjusted his diving equipment. "We'll start with the tunnel on the left. As before, I'll lead to look for trouble." Troy cast his searchlight around on the ceiling. "This is a strange place, but beautiful. It looks like another planet, doesn't it?" Nick pulled his mask back over his face and slipped the regulator in his mouth. He flopped backward into the seawater. Troy followed and, once under the surface, showed Nick the way to the first man-made tunnel. This tunnel was on the other side of the cave, about 12 feet below the water at its lowest point. It was made of normal circular sewer pipe. The diameter of the pipe was about 5 feet, making the tunnel approximately the same size as the natural passageway between the ocean and the cave. Troy entered the tunnel gingerly. He swam back and forth from side to side, examining one wall for a few yards and then going across to the other. He almost missed the long, slender alarm box. It was embedded in the ceiling at a junction between two sections of sewer pipe, and Troy just happened to look up before he triggered the alarm. This system worked on a different principle. A camera or other optical device in the box on the ceiling took repeated images of a square foot of the tunnel bottom that was backlit by an illuminated square cleverly concealed below the normal concrete floor. Apparently, some kind of data comparison algorithm in the alarm processor contained logic by which the consecutive pictures could be assessed in terms of threat and an alarm triggered if necessary. It was the most complicated device of its kind that Troy had ever seen, and he quickly recognized the similarities between this system and the ocean telescope that had been on board the Florida Queen. "That means MOI designed and developed it," he thought to himself. "So I'd best be careful. I bet the algorithm is set so that disturbances to the camera trigger the alarm as well." Nick had swum over to the side of the tunnel out of the way and was watching Troy try to open up the alarm box without jiggling the optical instrument. To accommodate the almost 2-inch width of the box, there was a gap of that size everywhere around the circle connecting the two sequential sections of pipe. Throughout the rest of the tunnel, all adjoining sections were cemented together. Here, the passageway was discontinuous. "Curious," thought Nick. He idly shone his small flashlight into the blackness in the gap beside him, expecting to see nothing but a wall of rock. "What in the world is that?" he wondered, as his light fell upon some metal object that looked like a large grating. The grating was resting upon an old piece of railroad track. Nick looked more carefully. He could make out a gearbox and some pulleys, but he had no idea how all these mechanical devices fit together. Meanwhile, Troy had managed to remove the housing from the alarm box without disturbing the camera, and was busy trying to understand the inner workings of the system. "Phew,"
he thought. This is much too complicated to figure out in 5 minutes. If I can just isolate the alarm, that should be enough. It was tough work under the water, but Troy was clever, and the electronics were packaged in a logical fashion. He was able to find the alarm and disable it. Afterward, Troy lingered for several seconds trying to determine the purpose of the other circuits connected to the alarm subassembly. Nick had intended to show Troy what he had found in the gap. However, as he watched his friend struggling with the complex circuitry of the alarm box, he became again worried about the passage of time. It was now almost 9:45. He caught Troy's eye and pointed at his watch. Troy reluctantly abandoned his investigation of the alarm and proceeded down the tunnel. 30 yards farther, the tunnel passed what looked like a door to a submarine on their left. Both Troy and Nick tried pulling on the handle of the large and very heavy round door, but nothing happened. With gestures, Troy told Nick to continue trying to open the door while he swam on down the tunnel. The gold bars and other objects that remained from the Santa Rosa treasure were sitting in the tunnel another 30 yards beyond the round door. The passageway itself came to an abrupt halt against a rock wall. In front of the wall was an array of gold and silver objects, stacked to an average depth of 1 foot or so across the width of the tunnel. The treasure was not hidden in any way. It was simply scattered in random piles on the concrete floor at the end of the tunnel. Troy was ecstatic. "There's plenty here," he thought. "Enough for the aliens. Enough for Nick. Maybe even some left over for Carol and me." He swam back to find Nick. Nick was absolutely exultant when he saw the unmistakable smile on Troy's face. He raced around his friend to the end of the tunnel. When Nick first reached the treasure, he spent a minute or two swimming around, picking up each object that was different and dropping it back into the piles on the floor. "Holy shit," Nick said gleefully to himself as he and Troy started putting gold bars into the buoyancy bags. "I was right for once. There must be over 100 pounds in bars alone." They had agreed before the dive just to bring out the bars, provided there were enough. The bars were the only objects they could be certain were pure gold. "Even if we take 58 to Troy's friends, that might leave 50 or so for us." He did a quick mental calculation. "That could be over $300,000 apiece. Whoopee!" Joy and excitement surged through Nick. He was having difficulty containing himself. He wanted to sing, to dance, to jump with joy. He had been right after all. The bastards had stolen most of the treasure, and now he was stealing it back. There's no happiness quite like the redressing of an old and painful grievance. And to do it with panache, Nick was already celebrating in his heart. This was his day. Filling the bags took no time at all. Nick and Troy both felt as if they had infinite energy. When they had finished picking up the gold bars, Troy gestured down the tunnel. Nick looked down at the other treasure objects remaining on the floor. "We should take it all," he thought. "We should leave Homer and Greta nothing, nothing at all." But he had to be practical. Each of their bags was virtually full, and they would be heavy enough as they were. Nick swam off in the direction of the ocean, his buoyancy bag full of gold trailing behind him. Troy followed. As they passed the bulky door on the right, Troy found himself thinking again about the circuitry leading to the alarm in the box just ahead, between the two sections of pipe. What could those other connections be for? Suddenly, he remembered seeing a diagram in an electronics magazine about advanced timers that could reinitialize systems and swap out failed parts. By now, the component that Troy had disabled might have been declared a failure by the smart processor in the alarm box, in which case it would have either been replaced by a redundant part or the system would be ignoring its output. In either situation, Troy thought, that means the system could be active again. It was too late. Nick swam into the field of view of the optical device and lights came on throughout the tunnel. A metal gate started closing behind Nick and his bag of gold. It was only with a burst of speed that Troy propelled himself through before the gate shut completely. But his buoyancy bag full of gold bars was left behind on the other side of the gate. Nick stared at Troy's lost bag as it floated to the floor. He reached through the bars, grabbed the bag, and tried to pull it through. It was useless. He shook the gate. The metal was extremely sturdy. Angry and frustrated, he punched the gate with his fists. As Nick caught his breath in between punches, he became aware of a strange droning sound, like a motor somewhere in the distance behind him. He turned around to find Troy. He could not see him anywhere. Troy had been exhausted by his swimming sprint through the closing gate. His energy spent, he had let himself fall to the floor of the pool in the deepest part of the cave, halfway between the two man-made tunnels. He took several deep breaths through his mouthpiece and checked his air supply. He had about 10 minutes remaining. He watched for a moment as Nick, almost out of sight to his right, tried fruitlessly to pull Troy's bag through the gate. Shit, Troy thought, disappointed that he had lost the gold. If only I had been thinking. I should have known. He heard an unusual sound off to his left. Curious, Troy swam over to the entrance of the other tunnel and right into the path of the robot sentry. Even though the original distance between them was over 50 feet, the guidance mechanism of the sentry fixed on Troy as soon as he appeared. Startled and fascinated, at first Troy did not try to avoid the onrush of the bullet-shaped submarine. The sentry was 3 feet long and a foot wide in its midsection. When it was about 8 feet away, the sentry slowly loaded and fired a small but powerful spear, the size of a table knife, that Troy just managed to avoid as it hurtled past. The spear crashed into the wall beside him. Adrenaline surged into Troy's system, and he swam out into the middle of the pool. The sentry did not follow him immediately. Instead, it moved over in front of the natural passageway to the ocean, thereby cutting off the escape route, and then turned around to make a systematic search of the pool. Damn it, Troy was thinking. Why didn't I leave while I had the chance? He wondered if Nick was still over by the gate. The sentry had now found Nick in its field of vision. He was swimming slowly toward the exit with his buoyancy bag. He was unaware that he and Troy were not alone in the pool. By the time Nick saw the sentry, he was 15 feet away and within easy range of its underwater gun. Troy watched the sentry load a spear. Oh, no, he cried out to himself. Watch out, Nick. There was nothing he could do. It happened so fast that neither Nick nor Troy knew exactly what occurred. Troy would later explain that he felt a sudden warm tingle on his wrist, and then something, a light beam or a laser burst or a stream of plasma, perhaps, fired out of his bracelet and zapped the robot sentry into silence and motionlessness. Nick would say that the sentry, just when it was going to fire at him, was first distracted by Troy and then recoiled as if from an impact. Whatever happened, the sentry stopped all activity. Immediately thereafter, the two men swam together over to the shallow part of the cave. They were temporarily safe. Carol could not believe how plump and succulent the oysters were. Ellen was sitting at the other end of the table opposite her and was beaming with pride. "Would you like some more, dear?" she smiled, lifting the huge pot containing the oyster stew. "I'm now going to eat a second portion," Carol thought. In addition to the catfish with Nick, Greta would be disgusted. She smiled to herself and nodded at Ellen. There was at least one thing she had learned this evening. Ellen was certainly a fantastic cook. And a very sad person, too, Carol thought, as she spooned herself some more spicy stew, rich with the fabled Apalachicola oysters. Homer had personally answered all the questions during the 20-minute interview before dinner. Whenever a question had been controversial or delicate, such as when Carol had asked about the allegations that part of the treasure haul had been secretly stolen and hidden by the three of them, he had looked only at Greta before he made a response. No wonder Ellen eats all the time. She's the odd man out. Or is it woman? This stew is fabulous, Carol remarked to Ellen. Would you mind giving me the recipe? Ellen was delighted. Certainly, dear, she said. It would be my pleasure. Carol remembered Dale's reference to Ellen's behavior at the MOI Awards dinner and wondered if there was, indeed, any sexual component to the warmth Ellen was displaying. I don't see it, Carol decided. This is just a lonely and profoundly disturbed woman. I don't feel one iota of sexual tension.
You've been asking the questions all evening, Miss Dawson, Homer was saying. Now, why don't we ask you a few?
He had been surprisingly pleasant and subdued since the bizarre preprandial shark feeding. They must be normal sometimes, Carol thought. Otherwise, they couldn't survive. But who knows when Mr. Hyde will show up again?
Yeah,
Greta said. It was the first time she had spoken directly to Carol during the meal.
Homer told me you were with Dr. Dale. You are lovers, no?
You don't beat around the bush, do you, Greta? Carol partially evaded the question.
Dale Michaels and I are very good friends. We spend quite a lot of time together, both socially and professionally.
He is a smart man, Greta said. Those clear eyes stared at Carol, and a smile played at the corner of Greta's lips. What is she trying to tell me? The conversation was interrupted by the sound of a sharp alarm. Carol knew immediately that something had gone wrong.
What in the world is that?
Carol asked innocently as the strident alarm continued with its loud bursts. Homer and Greta were already up from the table.
Excuse us, Homer said. It's our burglar alarm. Probably an error. We'll go check it out.
They hurried out of the dining room, leaving Carol and Ellen alone, and headed down a nearby hallway. I must follow them and find out what's going on, Carol thought, her heart and mind racing together. She sneaked a peek at her watch. It was 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. They should have finished by now.
I'm going to the restroom, she said to Ellen. Don't bother, she added, as Ellen started to explain the directions. I'm sure I can find it myself.
Carol walked quickly into the hall and listened for sounds of Homer and Greta. Moving very quietly, she followed them until she was just outside a large den on the opposite side of the house. The door to the den was ajar.
It will focus in a second, she heard Homer say.
There was a pause.
Shit, he shouted. It looks like the gold bars are already gone. They must have moved very fast. The picture is really not very clear. Here, you take a look.
Yeah, said Greta. The bars are gone, I think. But, Homer, the gold would be very heavy. Maybe the thieves are trapped in the tunnel. Timmy could search for them.
That would fix the bastards.
Homer's nervous laugh sent chills down Carol's spine. She backpedaled slowly until she had retreated to the main foyer of the house. She heard an outside door slam in the direction of the den.
They've gone out to turn the sharks loose. Jesus, I must warn Nick and Troy.
Carol turned into the nearest bathroom in the hallway, pushed the door closed, and turned on the water faucet. Then she flushed the commode and untaped the small walkie-talkie that was hidden inside her shirt. She put the unit right next to her mouth.
Mayday, mayday, she said. They know you're there. You are in danger.
She repeated the message and then pushed the button that would automatically recycle the communication several more times. I certainly hope this damn thing works, she thought. She started to affix the tiny unit to the inside of her blouse again. While she was taping it down, she happened to look in the mirror. Her heart nearly stopped. Ellen was standing in the doorway staring at her, the baleful glare in her eyes indicating that she had seen and heard everything. She took a step toward Carol.
Just hold it right there, Ellen, Carol said.
Carol put her hands up. I have no quarrel with you. The fat woman hesitated.
Homer and Greta only use you anyway, Carol added softly. Why don't you leave them and make a life for yourself?
Anger broke across Ellen's face. Her eyes narrowed, her cheeks reddened, and she raised her huge fists to threaten Carol.
It's none of your damn business how I live my life, she said menacingly.
She moved again in Carol's direction. Carol grabbed the thick metal towel rack beside her and pulled with all her might. The bar sprung free from the wall, dumping two peach bath towels and a wooden end piece on the linoleum floor. Carol brandished the bar over her head.
Don't make me hit you, she said. Just move aside and get out of my way.
Ellen did not slow down. Carol aimed carefully and struck her hard on the right shoulder. The heavy woman collapsed.
Greta,
she wailed in a monstrous voice.
Greta, help me.
Still waving the bar from the towel rack, Carol walked carefully around Ellen and backed toward the door. Once in the hall, she sprinted to the family room and headed for the front door. Right beside the wet bar, she was tackled from behind. Carol fell forward hard and smashed her nose on the carpet. She tried to squirm out of Greta's arms, but it was impossible. She was penned. A few drops of blood trickled out of Carol's nose and fell on the carpet. Both women were breathing heavily. Carol managed to turn her body around so that she was facing Greta. She struggled vainly to free herself. Greta's strong arms slammed Carol's wrists against the floor. Greta bent down until her face was only inches away from Carol's.
You were trying to get away, yeah? And just why were you in such a hurry?
There was something feral in Greta's eyes. On impulse, Carol lifted her head and kissed Greta full on the lips. Startled, her assailant's arms momentarily relaxed. That was all Carol needed. Gathering all her strength, she smashed the bottom of her palm into the side of Greta's head. Greta was stunned. Carol pushed her off and made a dash for the door. Carol was already calculating when she ran out the front door and down the steps. Greta will be up in an instant, she thought. I won't have time to open the car door. I might as well run for it. The German woman was only 15 yards behind her and gaining fast when Carol turned into the lane that led from Homer's house to the Pelican Resort. For 10 years I have run 3 times a week, but this is the only time my life has ever depended on it. She tried to accelerate. Greta continued to close the gap. Carol was certain she was going to be caught at any minute. Once she thought she felt Greta's hand on her blouse. But after 200 yards, Greta began to drop back. When she was a quarter of a mile from Homer's driveway, Carol dared to look over her shoulder. Her pursuer was clearly struggling and was now 50 yards behind her. Carol felt a renewed burst of energy. I'm going to make it, she thought. I'm actually going to escape. Greta slowed to a walk. Eventually, Carol did too, but not until she was almost to the restaurant. Even then, she continued to look back, to try to find her antagonist in the moonlight. Now I'll call a taxi, she was thinking, and go over to Nick's apartment. I hope that the two of them heard my warning and are safe. She could no longer see Greta. She stopped and strained her eyes. She must have turned back, Carol thought. While she was looking back down the lane, a pair of very strong hands grabbed her shoulders. She spun around and stared into the laughing eyes of Lieutenant Richard Todd. 10. He had purposely waited until all the rest of the actors had left the dressing room. The package itself was inconspicuous, about the size of a large bar of soap, wrapped in white paper with a dark red ribbon. You don't even know if it's from her, Winters thought as he pulled the bow on the ribbon. The commander was full of anticipation. The show had been even better tonight, and in the bedroom scene, he had felt, for just a second, the touch of Tiffany's tongue against his lips. She didn't have to do that, Winters told himself, suspending for a moment all vestiges of guilt. His hands trembled a little as he opened the package. It was a plain white box. Inside was a silver cigarette lighter, simple but handsome, with the initials VW engraved on the outside at the bottom. His heart raced. So she does feel it, too. Commander Winters felt a powerful burst of lust in his groin. Now he was imagining a scene no more than 3 or 4 hours in the future. He was taking Tiffany home and they were kissing at her front door. Would you like to come in? She would say. I feel pretty. Oh, so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and gay. He heard her singing as she came down the hall. She pushed open the door to his dressing room and twirled around. Tiffany's hair was stacked high on her head, showing the lines of her elegant neck. The gold filigree along the top of the comb that the commander had given her blended in perfectly with the rich red and brown of her hair. Her dress was white, low-cut, with her shoulders exposed, except for tiny straps in the corners. Well, she said with a big and eager smile. She turned around again. What do you think? You look beautiful, Tiffany, he replied. He stared at her with such intensity that she blushed.
Oh, Vernon, she sighed, now changing her mood. The combs are wonderful.
She pulled a cigarette from his pack on the dresser table and lit it herself with his new lighter. She took a deep drag, her eyes fixed on his, and put the cigarette down in the ashtray.
I don't know how to thank you, she murmured.
She walked over to him and put her hands in his.
It's already been another wonderful evening.
She put her left hand behind his head and reached up to kiss him. His heart was about to explode within his body. She could feel his arousal as her lips nestled softly against his. She pulled his head down to meet hers and subtly increased the pressure of her kiss. At length, he put his arms around her and pressed her body against his. Commander Winters thought he was going to drown in the pleasure of that kiss. Never had he felt such longing. He was certain he would gladly die in the morning if he could just continue to kiss her all night first. For a moment, as he let himself experience fully the rush of joy and love and lust, all his worries and despair were pushed aside. He wanted to wrap himself around Tiffany, somehow zip her inside his skin, and close out everything else in the universe. Melvin and Mark had come to the dressing room to find the commander. They had not approached with stealth, and were not even being especially quiet, but neither Tiffany nor Commander Winters heard them walk up. The two men could see the pair kissing through the open dressing room door. They looked at each other and reached out instinctively to touch hands for an instant. From their own experience, they knew about the difficulty of love affairs outside the accepted norm. Tiffany and Winters finally broke the kiss, and she put her head against his chest. Her back was to the door. Winters opened his eyes and saw Melvin and Mark standing there in front of him. He blanched, but the director made a gesture with his hands that said, "It's all right, it's your business, not ours." Melvin and Mark considerately waited several seconds so that it would look as if they had not arrived until after the kiss. The commander patted Tiffany on the shoulder and turned her around in a fatherly manner.
"Great show, Commander," Melvin said as he walked into the room. "And another super performance from you, too, young lady." He paused.
Mark smiled his compliments, and Tiffany unconsciously straightened out her dress.
"There's a Lieutenant Todd waiting outside for you, Commander," Melvin added. "He says it's urgent. He asked me to tell you to hurry."
Winter's face was creased with wrinkles. "What in the world is he doing here?" he thought. "It's after 10 o'clock on a Saturday night."
"Thanks, Melvin," he answered. "Tell him I'll be out in a few minutes."
The director and his friend turned and left the dressing room. Tiffany reached over for the lit cigarette, whose ash had grown so long it had nearly fallen out of the ashtray. She inhaled and handed it to Winters.
"Did they see us kissing?" she asked anxiously.
"No," lied Winters, but already he was realizing how untenable his fantasy was.
"Precious Tiffany," he thought. "My teenage lover. We were lucky. But we cannot kid ourselves. We will be seen eventually." He looked into her eyes and saw the flame of adolescent passion. Again he felt the surge in his loins. He reached down and pulled her forcefully to him. "And if the wrong person sees us," he thought as his lips tingled with her kiss, "there is no limit to my risk."
Winters threw his cigarette down on the ground and stomped it out. He shook his head in disbelief. "You are telling me that you have taken those three into custody and you're holding them at the base?"
Lieutenant Todd was confused.
"But, sir, don't you understand? We have an entire set of photographs. In three of them, you can clearly see the missile. And there are other pictures that show the black guy in some kind of underwater structure down there in the ocean. Just as I had guessed. What more could we possibly need? We also caught them red-handed, no less, coming back from a dive with 50 pounds of gold bars in their backpacks. 50 pounds!
Commander Winters turned around and went back in the theater. "Go back to the base, Lieutenant," he said disgustedly. "I'll be there in 5 minutes." It was apparent that Melvin and Mark were just waiting for Tiffany and the commander before they locked up the theater and went to the party.
"Can you take her over, Melvin?" he asked. "There's a big mess out at the base tonight, and it looks as if I will have to straighten it out."
The conversation with Todd had been sobering for Winters on at least two levels. First, it had reminded him that there was a real world out there, outside of the theater, a world that would not look kindly on a 43-year-old Navy commander having a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old high school student. Secondly, Todd's astonishing announcement that he had indeed detained three civilians, one of whom was a well-known reporter, jolted the commander into realizing that his preoccupation with Tiffany had affected his work. "I should never have let this thing get so far out of control," he thought. "From here on out, that lieutenant makes no move that I don't personally approve." "I'm sorry, Tiffany," he said in a fatherly voice. He gave her an ambiguous hug and a light kiss on the top of her head. "I'll come to the party as soon as I can."
"Hurry, or you'll miss the champagne," Tiffany said with a smile.
Melvin turned off the lights in the theater. The four of them walked out the door. Winters had parked down the street almost a block away. He waved to Tiffany as she climbed into Melvin's car. "I wonder if you will ever know, young lady," he thought. "Know how close I came tonight to throwing everything away." In his mind's eye, it was 24 years before, on a cold night outside of Philadelphia, and he had just gone berserk and virtually raped Joanna Carr. Winter started his Pontiac and eased into the street. It would be so easy, he thought. Just one time to forget the rules and constraints. To dive into the water without looking first. He remembered his pact with God after he had spent the night with Joanna. "So you kept your part of the bargain, I guess, and I became an officer and a gentleman. And a killer." He winced. He turned the car past the swank Miyako Gardens and headed for the base. With great effort, he forced himself to stop thinking about Tiffany and Joanna and sex. "It's not enough that I have this trial with Tiffany. At the same time, I am assigned a redneck lieutenant who runs roughshod over civilians in his attempt to prove some cockamamie..." Commander Winter stopped at a signal. Slowly, the full impact of what Todd had told him began to sink in. "Jesus, I may be in trouble, too. Unlawful entry, wrongful detention. They'll throw the book at Todd." He eased his car through the intersection. He mechanically put a cigarette in his mouth and lit it. "So I should be apologetic. But shit, that Dawson woman is a reporter. Bad, bad news." He had arrived at the base. He waved to the security guard and drove on to where Todd had said they were keeping the trio. Winter stopped in front of a plain white building situated on a small hill about 15 feet above the street level. A nervous Lieutenant Roberto Ramirez was waiting at the edge of the road. He was holding two large, thick envelopes in his hands. Ramirez turned and called something toward the front door. Todd came out in a moment. He locked the door carefully, came down the steps, and walked toward the other two officers. Ramirez was already showing the photographs to Commander Winters when Todd joined them. The three men had a short but animated discussion.
"So what happened after you received my message?" Carol turned to the other two as soon as Todd disappeared out the door. They had not had many chances to talk in private since Todd and Ramirez had taken them into custody in the parking lot at the Pelican Resort.
"Troy was ready to split," Nick laughed, "but I thought your warning only referred to the robot sentry, and since he had been quiet for several minutes, I figured we were already safe. I was still really pissed off about the second bag of gold bars, so I hurried back over to the gate. I was concentrating so hard on finding a way to pull the bag through the opening that I must have been oblivious to everything else. Suddenly, I felt Troy jerk me backwards. Maybe a second later, two or three sharks, one definitely a Mako, slammed hard into the gate. I was certain the gate was going to fall into pieces."
"Those sharks were really nasty, Angel," Troy interjected. "And stupid, too. The big one must have banged against the gate a dozen times before he gave up."
The buoyancy bag with the gold bars was immediately ripped to shreds by the crazy sharks. They may even have swallowed most of the bars themselves. It was not fun being that close to them. Nick shuddered. "When I close my eyes, I can still see that Mako's teeth 3 feet away from me. I'll probably have bad dreams for years."
I pulled Nick toward the ocean. I didn't want any part of those mean bastards, and I didn't trust the gate to remain intact in case they launched another attack. We made it out in record time. Of course, neither of us expected to be greeted by the U.S. Navy when we returned to the station wagon. Troy paused. This Todd character, what's his problem anyway? He sure thinks he's a badass. Is he just pissed because the professor decked him last night? Carol smiled. She reached her left hand over and put it on Nick's leg just above the knee. Her hand remained there while she was talking. Todd is one of the naval engineers trying to find the lost missile. I'm certain that he and his men must have been responsible for the break-ins at Nick's apartment and my hotel room. Otherwise, they wouldn't have detained us. What grounds do they have for holding us? Nick inquired. He dropped his hand down and wrapped it around Carol's. It's not against the law to have gold bars in a backpack. Don't we have rights as citizens that prevent this kind of thing? Probably, Carol replied. She squeezed Nick's hand and then retracted her own. But as a reporter, I find this part of our adventure extremely interesting. You can tell that Lieutenant Ramirez is very nervous. He wouldn't let Todd even ask us any questions until Commander Winters was contacted. And he has been very concerned about our comfort. As if on cue, the front door opened and the three naval officers walked in. Winters was in the lead with the two lieutenants just behind. Nick and Carol and Troy were sitting on gray metal auditorium chairs on the left of a partitioned area that served as a waiting room for the larger offices in the rear of the building. Winters moved into the area and half leaned against the large gray desk opposite them. "I'm Commander Vernon Winters," he said, his eyes meeting each of theirs in turn. "As Miss Dawson knows, I'm one of the senior officers on the base here. I am currently in charge of a secret project, code-named Broken Arrow," he smiled. "I'm sure you are wondering why you have been brought to the base." Winters reached out with his left arm, and Ramirez handed him the infrared blow-ups that showed the missile in the most detail. He waved the photos at the three detainees. "One of the goals of Project Broken Arrow is to find a Navy missile that has been lost somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico. Lieutenant Todd here believes, based on these photographs, that you know where that missile is. That is why he has acted to bring you here for questioning." Winter's voice rose in pitch, and he began to wave his arms. "Now, I'm certain I don't need to remind you that state-of-the-art weapons systems are what keep our nation free and secure."
"Spare us the patriotic lecture and the histrionics, Commander Winters," interrupted Carol. "We all know that you were searching for a lost missile and that you think we may have found it. Sorry. We went out looking for it today, but were unable to locate it again." She stood up. "Now you listen to me a minute. Your zealous lieutenant there and his men have broken more laws than I can count. In addition to kidnapping us, they have looted and vandalized my hotel room and Mr. Williams' apartment. They have also stolen some photographs and valuable equipment."
She fixed Winters with a hard gaze.
"You sure as hell better have good reason for dragging us down here, or I swear I'll see to it that all three of you are court-martialed."
Carol glanced at Ramirez. He was squirming.
"In the meantime," she continued, "you can start by giving us an official written apology, returning all our property and making adequate payment for all the damages. In addition, I want exclusive access to all Broken Arrow files from this moment on. If you don't agree to all these terms, you might as well prepare right now to read about the Gestapo tactics of the United States Navy in the next edition of the Miami Herald."
"Uh-oh," thought Winters. "This is not going to be easy. This woman reporter intends to play the bluff and threat game." He pulled out a cigarette while he was thinking.
"Would you please not smoke in here?" Carol broke into his train of thought. "We all find it offensive."
"Damn these aggressive non-smokers."
He replaced the pell-mell in the pack in his pocket. Winters had been thrown off at first by Carol's rapid attack, but he eventually regained his composure.
"Now, Miss Dawson," the commander began a minute later. He looked away from the trio in the direction of the front door. "I can understand why you might be upset by what has happened. I will admit that our men may indeed have acted in an unwarranted manner while they were searching your rooms to find evidence. However,
Winter stopped in mid-sentence, turned around, and came back toward Nick and Carol and Troy. However, he repeated, we are talking about treason here. He waited to let his threat register. And I don't need to tell you, Miss Dawson, that treason is serious business, even more serious than journalism. He hesitated again for effect, and his voice became very stern. If any of you have knowledge of the whereabouts of this missile and have conveyed that knowledge to a member of any foreign government, especially one viewed as inimical to our national interests, then you have committed treason.
What kind of dope have you been smoking, Commander? Carol replied. We freely admit that we've been looking for your missile. But that doesn't make us spies. You have no case against us.
She glanced at Nick. He was admiring her performance.
I'm simply a reporter covering a story. This treason business of yours is pure fabricated bullshit.
Oh, yeah? Said Lieutenant Todd, unable to restrain himself.
Then where were these pictures taken?
He showed the photo of Troy in full diving regalia in the initial underwater room with the red and blue walls. He then turned and pointed to the backpacks sitting in the opposite corner of the room.
And what were your two friends doing with 50 pounds of gold after their dive tonight?
All right, man, Troy remarked in an exaggerated manner.
He took a step toward Lieutenant Todd.
All right. You figured it out, haven't you? We found the missile and sold it to the Russians for 50 pounds of gold.
His eyes widened as he looked at Todd.
And now the missile is on board a submarine on its way to Moscow or wherever. Come on, man, get serious. We're not that stupid.
Lieutenant Todd's temper flared up. You black bastard, he muttered before Commander Winters jumped between them. Winters needed some time to think. Todd's questions were, after all, still unanswered. Even if there were good answers, it was not difficult to understand how someone could have come to the conclusion, based on the photographs, that there might be a conspiracy involved. In addition, there was the issue of defending the actions of his junior officers and the investigating team.
If I let these three go now, thought Winters, then we are essentially admitting that we made an error in the first place. Ramirez was gesturing at the commander. He nodded outside with his head. Winters did not understand at first, but Ramirez repeated the motion.
Excuse us a second, Winters said.
The two officers walked out on the porch above the steps, leaving Todd with Nick and Carol and Troy.
What is it, Lieutenant? Winters asked.
Commander, sir, Ramirez answered. My career is the Navy. If we release these three now, after no formal questioning...
I couldn't agree more, Winters interrupted abruptly. I wish that none of this today had happened, but it did. Now we must finish it up properly and thoroughly, or we have no defense for what we did.
He thought for a minute.
How long would it take you to get the video and sound equipment set up for a formal interrogation?
About 30 minutes, Ramirez replied. Maybe 45 at the most.
Let's do it. While you're getting ready, I'll prepare the list of questions.
Shit, said Winters to himself, as he watched Ramirez walk briskly toward his office on the other side of the base. I am indeed going to be here all night. He thought of his missed chance with Tiffany. I'd better call her and explain while I'm drafting these questions. He felt a sudden burst of anger toward Lieutenant Todd. As for you, he thought, if we come out of this unscathed, I will personally see to it that you are transferred to Lower Slabovia.
It was after 11 o'clock. Lieutenant Todd stood near the front door. He was holding a billy club in his hand. Once before in the evening, just after Nick and Troy had reached the Pelican Resort parking lot, Todd had used the club on Nick's back to coerce him into the car. Nick could still feel the welt.
How long is all this going to take? Troy asked. He was standing near the desk. Can't we go home now and get some sleep and come back on Monday morning?
You heard what the man said, Todd replied.
He was definitely gloating.
They've gone off to prepare for a formal interrogation. You should be using this time to get your story straight.
Todd pounded his palm with a billy club. Troy turned to his companions. All right, team, he said with a wink. I move we blow this joint. Let's overpower this geek and blast out of here. Just try it, you shits, Todd rejoined. He smacked one of the empty folding chairs with his club for emphasis. I'd like nothing better than to report that you tried to escape. Nick had not said much since Winters and Ramirez had left. He now looked across the room at Todd. You know what annoys me the most about this, Lieutenant? He said to his captor. It's that people like you, he continued without waiting for an answer, end up in positions of power or authority all over the world. Look at you. You think that because you have us under your control, that makes you somebody. Let me tell you something. You aren't shit. Todd did not try to hide his dislike for Nick. At least I can find white men to be my friends, he replied sarcastically. I do declare, Troy chimed in swiftly. I believe our associate, Lieutenant Todd, may be a bigot. We may be talking to a true live honky. Let's see if nigger is his next.
Boys, boys, Carol interceded as Todd started to move toward Troy. Enough is enough.
The room became quiet. Troy walked back over to his friends and sat down in his chair. A minute later, Troy leaned over to Nick and Carol. As he was whispering to them, he put the gold bracelet right next to his mouth. You know, folks, he said, if we don't get out of here soon, we may be here all night. I can well imagine the questions taking 3 or 4 hours, and that means the Navy will get to the dive site before us in the morning.
But what can we do? Carol asked. It would be a miracle if they let us just walk out without any questions.
A miracle, Angel, said Troy with a grin, is just what we need. A good old-fashioned miracle, like the Blue Fairy.
What are you shits whispering about over there? The truculent Lieutenant Todd began to walk toward the bathroom at the west end of the long room. Knock it off, and don't try anything. The outside door is locked, and I have the key.
He didn't close the bathroom door. The urinal was fortunately out of view to the right. There was not much light in the back of the small bathroom. As Todd was finishing his piss, he became aware of a strange sensation all over his right side, as if 1,000 very small needles were sticking in him. Puzzled, he turned toward the corner. What he saw there sent an incredible shock of terror racing through his system. In the corner, partially hidden in the poor light, was what could only be described as a 6-foot carrot. The thicker end of the creature was balanced on 4 webbed pads planted on the floor. There were no arms, but about 5 feet above the ground, just under a maze of blue spaghetti of unknown purpose on top of its head, 4 vertical slits, each 1 foot long, were cut in what might have been its face. Out of each of these slits, something strange was hanging. Troy would later explain to Nick and Carol that these were sensors that the carrot saw, heard, smelled, and tasted with these dangling extensions. Lieutenant Todd did not wait to study the creature. He let out a whoop and backed quickly out of the bathroom. He did not stop to retract his penis or zip his fly. When the weird orange thing next appeared in the light at the door to the bathroom, the lieutenant was certain it was going to follow him. He stared at it, petrified and immobile, for 1/2 a second. Then, when it did indeed move toward him, Todd immediately turned around, unlocked the front door, and burst through it. Unfortunately, he forgot about the 8 concrete steps. In his panic, he tripped and fell. He smacked his head hard on the 2nd step and tumbled down to the bottom. He lay unconscious on his back on the sidewalk in front of the building. Carol had cowered against Nick when she had first seen the carrot. Then they had both glanced at Troy. He was smiling and humming to himself.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
He seemed so blasé about everything that Nick and Carol even relaxed temporarily. However, after Lieutenant Todd disappeared out the front door and the carrot turned to face them, it was difficult to remain calm.
Nuts, said Troy with a big smile. I was really hoping for the Blue Fairy. I thought she might make me rich, or maybe even white.
All right, Jefferson, Nick said. His face looked as if he had just eaten a lemon. Please explain what that thing in front of us is. Troy first walked slowly over to the corner of the room to pick up their backpacks.
"This, Professor," he replied, as he then walked directly up to the carrot, "is what we might call a holographic projection."
He put his hand into and through the orange body.
"Somewhere in the universe, there is supposedly a real life creature like this, but they have only sent his image to help us escape."
Even with Troy's explanation, Nick and Carol did not want to come any closer to the stationary carrot than was absolutely necessary. They moved with their backs against the walls until they reached the door.
"Don't worry," Troy laughed. "It won't hurt you."
The sensor hanging out of the slit on the far right of the carrot's head was totally incomprehensible. Carol could not take her eye off of it. It looked like a wad of gooey honeycomb stuck on the end of a majorette's baton.
"What does it do with that?"
Carol asked, pointing as she preceded Troy out the door.
"I don't know, Angel," Troy answered, "but it must be fun."
Nick and Troy joined Carol on the platform at the top of the stairs. They all saw Todd at about the same time. They were naturally surprised to find him lying at the bottom of the steps. His head was bleeding.
"Should we help him?"
Carol wondered out loud as Troy bounded down the stairs in front of her.
"No way," Nick replied quickly.
Troy bent down beside Todd and carefully examined the unconscious lieutenant from head to toe. He slapped the big man lightly on the cheek. Lieutenant Todd did not move. Troy winked at his friends at the top of the stairs.
"The professor was right, my man," he said, breaking into a grin. "You really aren't shit."
"So I kissed her," Carol said with a laugh.
"You did what?" asked Nick.
They were in Troy's old Ford LTD driving toward the Hemingway Marina. After leaving the base, they had walked the mile and a half to Troy's duplex to pick up his car. Carol was beside Troy in the front seat, and Nick was in the back, next to the backpacks containing the gold and the information disks. Carol turned around to Nick.
"I kissed her."
She laughed again as Nick screwed up his face in disgust.
"What was I supposed to do? The woman is stronger than most men. She had me pinned on the floor. There was something just a little suggestive about the way she was holding me."
"Woo-wee, Angel." Troy slapped the dashboard with his left hand. "You are amazing. What did Superkraut do next?"
"She released her grip on my wrists, just for a second. I think she was deciding whether to kiss me back."
"Yuck," said Nick from the back seat. "I think I'm going to be sick." "So you smashed her upside of the head and then ran off?" asked Troy.
Carol nodded. Troy laughed heartily and then became more serious.
"Be careful if you ever see her again, Angel. Greta does not like to lose."
"But you're wrong about her in one respect, Carol," Nick remarked. "Greta's not into women at all. She likes sex with men too much."
Carol found Nick's comment smug and even irritating. She spoke across the front seat to Troy.
"Why is it, Troy, that men naturally assume that any woman who has sexual relations with men could not possibly be interested in having sex with another woman? Is this another example of their fundamental belief in their own innate superiority?"
She didn't wait for an answer. Carol turned around again to talk to Nick.
"And in case you're wondering, the answer is no, I'm not a lesbian. I am relentlessly heterosexual, as much because of my San Fernando Valley middle-class background as anything. But I will admit that sometimes I grow extremely tired of men and what I call their baboon demonstrations of macho."
"Hey," Nick replied. "I didn't mean to start an argument. I was just suggesting..."
"Okay, okay," Carol interrupted, loosening up a bit. "No harm done. I guess I am a little quick on the trigger."
She was quiet for a few seconds.
"By the way, Nick," she remarked then, "there's one part of this that I still don't understand completely. Why did Captain Homer go to such great lengths to hide the rest of the treasure all this time? Why didn't he just sell it off as soon as he could?"
"Lots of reasons," Nick replied, "not the least of which was fear that he might somehow be discovered and indicted for the perjury he committed during our trial. But this way he also escapes the IRS. The value of the gold appreciates in time, and most importantly, Greta has to hang around if she wants her whole share.
He almost certainly converts some of it to cash from time to time, probably through a third party, but never enough to call attention to the transaction.
So you see, Angel, Troy said, that's why there's no way he can call the police, because he would have to admit everything. I bet he's really pissed off.
Troy pulled into a left-hand turn lane and waited for the signal to change. A car pulled up beside them on the right next to Carol, and she just happened to look idly in that direction. It was a Mercedes. Later on, Carol would recall that time seemed to dilate for her. Each second of the next minute was recorded in her memory in super slow motion, as if it were covering a much longer period of time. Greta was driving Captain Homer's car and was staring at Carol. Homer was sitting beside her, waving his fists, shouting something that Carol couldn't hear through her closed window. Carol focused on Greta's amazing eyes. Never had she seen such hatred. For just an instant, Carol looked away to alert Troy and Nick. When she turned back, she saw that Greta had a pistol pointed directly at her. Three things happened almost simultaneously. Carol ducked, Troy pulled into the intersection against the red light, barely missing a speeding car, and Greta fired the gun. The bullet ripped through Carol's window and crashed into Troy's door, somehow miraculously missing them both. Carol sat cringing under the dashboard in the front seat. She fought against panic and tried to catch her breath. The chase was on. It was after 11:30 on a Saturday night in Key West, and the traffic in the residential area was light. Troy's Ford was no match for the Mercedes. Twice more, Greta maneuvered into position, and the Ford was sprayed with bullets. Windows were broken and pitted, but none of the occupants of the car was injured. Nick was lying on the floor in the back seat. "Get downtown if you can," he shouted at Troy. "Maybe we can lose them in the traffic." Troy was hunkered down behind the steering wheel as far as he could go. He could barely see the roadway in front of him. He was driving like a lunatic, swerving across the four-lane street into oncoming traffic, honking frantically, and making it impossible for Greta to predict his next move. "Where are the cops when you really need them?" he said out loud. "We have maniacs firing guns at us in the middle of Key West, and there are no men of blue anywhere in sight." After Nick's suggestion, Troy suddenly spun around in the middle of the street and started heading in the opposite direction. Greta was not prepared. She hit the brakes on the Mercedes, went into a skid, caromed off a parked car, and then resumed the chase. There were now no cars on the street in front of them, and the Mercedes was closing the gap. "Uh-oh," said Troy, fearing another attack. He violently pulled the steering wheel to the left, shot through an alley into a parking lot, and back onto a narrow street. A few moments later, he made a quick turn into a driveway. The car became flooded with light, and Troy jammed on the brakes. "Everybody out," he hollered. While Nick and Carol were trying to determine what the hell was happening, Troy was giving his car keys to a tall figure dressed in a red uniform. "We're just having drinks," he said. They heard the screech of the brakes on the Mercedes. "And those people behind us," Troy said in a loud voice to the half-dozen onlookers, including two parking attendants who were standing nearby, "have guns and are trying to kill us." It was too late for Greta and Homer to escape. Troy had driven into the parking entrance of a Miyako Gardens hotel, and already another car had come into the circular drive behind the Mercedes. Greta threw the car in reverse, smashed against the grill and bumper of the Jaguar behind her, and then tried to make a run for it by squeezing around Troy's Ford. Troy and the uniformed attendant dove for cover as Greta hit the open door of the Ford, lost control of the Mercedes, and eventually crashed into the parking kiosk in the middle of the driveway. As Nick and Carol stumbled out of the car, four hotel security men surrounded Greta and Homer. Troy walked over to join his friends. "Anybody hurt?" Both Carol and Nick shook their heads. Troy broke into a grand smile. "I guess that ought to take care of those characters," he said. Carol gave him a hug.
"It was a brilliant idea to drive here," she said. "What made you think of it?"
"Birds," Troy answered. "Birds?" Nick responded. "What the fuck are you talking about, Jefferson?" "Well, Professor," said Troy, opening the door to the elegant hotel and following his colleagues inside into the open atrium, "when they were about to catch us that last time, I realized that they were probably going to kill us for stealing their gold. and I wondered if there really were birds in heaven. My mother always told me that there were.
Troy, Carol said with a smile, you are so full of shit. Come to the point.
Exactly, Angel, he answered. Look around you. In the atrium of the Miyako Gardens was a magnificent aviary whose tiny threaded wire rose 4 stories into the air under a bank of skylights. Hundreds of colored birds played among the vines and palm trees and brought the real sound and feel of the tropics to the lobby of the hotel.
When I thought about birds, Troy could no longer restrain a crazy laugh, I realized we were in the vicinity of this hotel and the plan sort of jumped into my mind.
The three of them stood together and gazed up at the aviary. Carol was in the middle. She reached out her hands to both men. Repatriation. Beneath the emerald green ocean, the spacecraft rests quietly. Odd fish-like creatures swim by, observe the visitor from the heavens, and then continue on their journey. The final checkout before deployment is underway. When the checkout is completed, a door near the bottom of the craft opens, and a gold metallic sphere with a diameter of about 5 inches appears. The sphere is tied down on top of a long, narrow platform. The treads underneath the platform propel it down a small ramp and then across the sandy ocean floor. The flat-bodied vehicle and its cargo disappear in the distance. After a long wait, the strange moving platform returns to the spaceship without the golden sphere. The ramp slides back into the vehicle, the door closes, and the spacecraft is prepared for launch. Soon thereafter, the great ship eases forward in the water, rising until it is just beneath the surface of the Emerald Ocean. It then reconfigures itself, adds wings, steerable flaps, and other control devices, and breaks the water looking temporarily like an airplane. Its ascent into the blue sky, filled with light from the twin suns, is rapid and breathtaking. Orbital velocity is reached in almost no time. Once in orbit above the atmosphere, the aerodynamic surfaces are retracted, and the spaceship makes one final voyage around the planet Canther. When it reaches the proper true anomaly of its orbit, the craft accelerates quickly and hurtles again toward the cold and dark of interstellar space. The third delivery has been completed. 9 more remain on its 60-millicycle mission. 3 millicycles pass. The next target planet is only 6 systems away, another oceanic planet orbiting around a solitary yellow sun of unusual stability. The 4th cradle will be deposited there, on the 3rd body away from the star, a planet whose period of motion about its central sun is so short that it makes 14 revolutions in 1 millicycle. Before reaching the target, the spaceship makes a detour. It dives deep into the hydrogen-rich atmosphere of the largest planet in the new system, thereby accomplishing 2 goals. Its velocity with respect to the central star is significantly slowed through conversion of kinetic energy to dissipated heat, and its reservoir of raw elements and primitive chemical compounds from which the onboard manufacturing equipment creates all the backup and replacement parts is partially replenished. After exiting from the dive into the thick atmosphere, the interstellar Voyager covers the final distance to its target in a leisurely 600 nanocycles. During the approach, the automatic software in the central computer goes through a well-tested sequence designed to discover whether any of the conditions on the target planet have changed since the last complete set of systematic observations 3 cycles ago. Since the contents of each cradle have been uniquely designed based upon the environment of the specific planet where the zygotes must grow and flourish, any major change in that environment could drastically reduce the probability of survival for the repatriated species. Upon command from the computer, a battery of advanced remote sensing instruments is deployed to confirm the original design specifications for the planet. But the instruments do not, as planned, validate the set of design assumptions. The environment has changed. Not markedly,
not as if it had been reworked on a massive scale by an advanced intelligence for some specific purpose. The initial data strongly suggests, instead, that during the last cycle or two, some indigenous intelligence has emerged that has had a non-trivial impact on both the planet's surface and its atmosphere. As the remote sensing instruments continue their survey of the target planet, something even more unusual is discovered. There are artificial satellites, thousands of them, in orbit around the body. A space-faring species now makes this planet its home. An alarm is triggered in the central computer of the spaceship. The zygotes and the cradle system destined for this planet were not designed to deal with any other advanced species. However, the brilliant engineers of the colony had anticipated that at least one of the dozen target planets might have changed significantly during the three cycles since the last regular observations. A contingency protocol for handling new situations has been programmed into the approach sequence. Essentially, this protocol calls for careful analysis of the new conditions on the planet, assessment of the impact of those conditions on the key probability of survival parameters, and then, assuming that the impact assessment is not unsatisfactory, transfer, where possible, of new information into the electronic infrastructure responsible for the education of the repatriated species after cradle deployment.